Hi, everybody. My name's Chris Kelly. I'm an alcoholic. Is this good? We good with this? All right. My sobriety date's March 17, 2009. I'm a member in good standing of the Fourth Dimension Group of Newport Richey, and I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others. One of the speakers I listened to, he talks about treating God like he's real, and you know, God's a gentleman, and he won't come anywhere. He's not invited. So I'm going to take a quick moment of silence and invite God into this meeting. And you guys can, you know, I may suggest praying for the speaker, but let me see how this goes here. Thank you. Okay, so I'm born and raised in Newport Richey. I'm an only child, self-centered to the core right out of the gate. You know, I didn't even know there was other kids involved in life. You know, I just totally, I thought it was me. I got two loving parents that are still together to this day, and there was a lot of love in my house growing up, and good examples, and just really a good family to grow up in. I was a younger kid on the street. There was all older kids, and I always remember trying to do just stupid things to impress these older kids. And I just always wanted you to like me, you know, at any cost, whatever it was. I might get in trouble when I get home for doing whatever it was, but I'm going to make these cats like me. And that's just kind of the way I went through that awkward kind of stage in my life. I saw my fifth grade teacher today, and it brought back this memory that I didn't even think about since fifth grade, you know. And, you know, she wrote on my report card that I act out, and then I look around for approval. And I remember that because I got home. The teacher knew me for, like, you know, that school year and pegged me. It took me, like, 26 years to realize that. But, you know, she pegged me, and I saw her today, and I thought of that. And that's just kind of how I was. I was just goofy and always acting out and always seeking approval and never comfortable where I was. You know, if I had this bike, I wanted your bike. And once I got your bike, then I wanted the other kid's bike. I was just, you know, just all over the place. Around, like in middle school, my AA's given me just a total change of perception. And you know, today I work with my family's landscaping business, and I was cutting grass a few hours, you know, I don't wear this to work. I was cutting grass a few hours ago with my mother. And, you know, she's like one of the hardest working women I know. And I can look at that today and appreciate that and know that that is like the strongest lady I know, that, you know, not physically, but just a trooper. And you know, I remember coming off the bus, like, on Mondays. They would be working in my neighborhood right where my bus let off. And I hated Mondays because everything was about me. It was about not look at this hard-working woman, look at how it affects me. You know, I felt embarrassed seeing her on a lawnmower and just a goofy kind of way. Everything was about me. I just made everything about me. You know, not, oh, well, look, they're providing for you and you have these nice clothes and you go to school with food and fed and everything else. Not any of that. Look how it looks for me. And that didn't make me an alcoholic at all, but it absolutely put a little spin on what was going on in my head. And I just, you know, I just always was uncomfortable, always anxious. And this is all hindsight looking back. I didn't know any of it at the time. And by the way, I fit in just fine. You know, I had friends. I wasn't, like, extremely awkward or anything like that. You know, I had good friends, but I absolutely felt like, you know, if you knew who I really was, you wouldn't like me. And why the hell would you? Because I didn't like me. And, you know, I don't know, just really, really squirrely. So around the, you know, eighth grade, I think, a couple of friends I was hanging out with asked me if I would come over to their house on a Friday night and get drunk with them. They were planning to get drunk. And I said, absolutely. Because what I heard them say is, hey, will you come hang out with us? And of course, you know, anything to fit in with you, let's do it. I had no idea what alcohol was going to do for me. My dad is sober in AA, and he never, you know, there was never alcohol in my house growing up. There was a lot of, I don't know, maybe some alcoholic behavior, but never any alcohol. I don't really have many, I don't really have many memories of seeing him drunk or anything like that. So I kind of knew what alcohol was going to do, but I didn't at the same time. And I got drunk with these guys that asked me to drink with them that night, and I man, you know, and this is all looking back. At the time I threw up everywhere. I got in a fight with the kid that asked me to drink with him, and it was just a mess, right? That was the end of my social drinking, like, that night. It was just a mess. And, you know, but looking back today, I absolutely know that that was my solution. That was like a total transformation, because for that night, all that weirdness that I felt, any kind of, you know, I didn't care what you thought about me, and I would have told you what I felt about you. You know, I just did not care. I was just, I don't know, just all that. I could breathe for the first time. And, you know, I absolutely didn't head out to Skid Row the next day. I wasn't a daily drinker, but every time I could drink, I drank. And, I don't know, it was like, it was a weekends thing through high school. You know, we would plan the party on like Tuesday night, and we'd plan it for Friday. And then that was all I thought about. And looking back today, that's absolutely just a mental obsession, because I was going through the motions all week just to live for Friday night. And I had no clue that that was happening. Any kind of goals, any kind of anything I had went right out the window when drinking came into play. And I wasn't like, I didn't have these lofty goals, but whatever I did have going on was out the window. I knew what I was going to be doing from here on out. And, you know, I got drinking, and trouble came right along with it. And, you know, like, I got arrested at a prom. I wasn't going to the prom, but I went to the prom because this kid had shoes in my car. So I drove, like, it was just a mess. The kid was at the prom, and so we get pulled over and in the parking lot to the prom. So then everybody's getting out, and they're like looking in the car, like, what's going on with this kid? And that's just kind of the way my high school was. It just always getting in trouble. Always, that fifth grade teacher pegged me. You know, I was just always acting out. Always just. I don't know, just really a nuisance, really. So anyway, I graduate high school, barely slide by there, and I had rules throughout my whole, you know, growing up. I had a curfew. I had, like I said, I had pretty, you know, I had good parents. They instilled values in me and morals and all that stuff, and all that went out the window because I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I don't know, I had a pretty early curfew, and I don't know if it's still like this, but like when you're under 21 or 18 or something, the driving age, like, even though the curfew is, say, if you're 16, the curfew is 1 o'clock, well, you can't drive a car legally, like it says on the back of your license, till like midnight. And my parents were friends with these cops down the road, so the guy's like, oh yeah, we don't let our kid drive. And so, like, I was the only kid. I could be out an extra hour, but I had to have the car home, and it was just ridiculous. And, basically, I was drinking at any opportunity I could, and this was early on. And then as soon as I got out of the house, it was wide open, and I made it on my own like 4 months. That's how long I lasted running it the way I wanted to. And I got arrested, and it was the first time I came to AA. I was like 18 years old, and I don't know if you guys have ever been to Newport Rich AA, but it, like, 10 years ago, it was, well, this was my perception anyway. It was really bad. And it was like, I was like, it was a birthday night, and like, it was a candlelight meeting, and it was dark, and they were singing happy birthday to this, like, 100-year-old guy or something. I was like, what the hell am I doing here? You know, I didn't know what was going on. And it was brutal. And I was like, you know, my whole perception of it, I was like, well, this is what AA is. I don't want anything to do with this. And that was my attitude, and that's kind of the way I lived, and that's what I did, and I kept getting what I was getting, you know, that whole cliche. For the next 10 years, my life was just on a steady decline. And, I mean, I took some college courses, and I didn't see the progression of my drinking in my transcripts. You hear that a lot, you know. I didn't see it there because I never really went to school that often. But I saw the progression of my drinking in the treatment centers I was going to, you know. So I would start showing up at these, like, the first one I went to was a fancy one in Jacksonville, and my parents shelled out some pretty good money for it. And you know, by the end of the deal, I'm in Department of Corrections taking mandatory treatment in there. But that was pretty much how it went. You know, over those next 10 years or whatever, I was, and kind of just checking the time here, I don't want to bore you with all the gruesome details, but it was, you know, anytime I just couldn't stop getting arrested. You know, the arrest, I'm not any kind of like big crook or anything. It was all drug charges and stuff like that. And I know this is an AA meeting, and I promise you, if I would have been thinking about that like 15 years ago, I would have not done the drugs. But that's, you know, it's just you know, I truly have the utmost respect for the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's part of my story of why I kept getting arrested. So I think it's fitting to say. So I'd get arrested, I'd get out, I'd show up at my parents' house, I had nowhere to go, and, you know, hope would be up, they would, all right, well, we'll take you to this meeting, and because my dad knew where the meetings were, you know, and I'd hitch a ride with him, and still never connected with anybody, and they'd be feeling a little better, and then that obsession would start eating in on me, and they'd go to work, and I'd be sitting home alone, and I'd be like, well, nah, you know, when I got out of prison, I had this entire dresser drawer full of different meeting lists with guys' number, Steven's number on them, all kind of people's numbers on them. You know, I just never used them. And, you know, each time that they're, you know, I would raise their hope, things would be going good, and then I'd crash it back down again. And that was just a pattern that I kept repeating over and over and over. You know, they stood by me through absolutely everything, and I introduced them to a level of lifestyle that they were not accustomed to. I can promise you that. Basically, I wound up in drug court at whatever that is, a treatment center in St. Pete on the south side that some guys from here bring meetings in. I remember the meetings they would bring in. And see, I don't need your solution if I don't think I have your problem. And that's where I was at. And it was just the same crap. I was jumping through hoops to get a lesser charge or to have my parents not so mad at me. Or, you know, I was never serious about this thing. I couldn't identify. I can absolutely identify with the book today where it talks about the real alcoholic will, you know, use every form of self-deception to convince himself he's not an alcoholic, and that's what I was doing. So I do good in jail because the doors shut and the gates and the locks and everything, and I'm not getting out. But at the place I was at in St. Pete, it's not like that. And you go out for a rec, and like the gate's wide open at the end of the little basketball court. So I walked out of there twice. They let me back in, you know, the first time, and then I walked off again. And each time I would leave with everything I owned in a trash bag. And I mean, I was not raised to be doing this kind of stuff. You know, there was a time when alcohol was working for me, and I would be the life of the party. You know, we would get dressed up and we would come down here to Ybor and Channelside, and I would close bars, and it was a lot of fun, and I was still able to make it to work, so I still had some money to go waste at these places. And over the years, the progression, I just kept, you know, like I said, I'm in this state-funded treatment center. I'm like writing my parents and calling them collect to have them bring me, you know, a new pair of sneakers or whatever it was, and that's where my life was. I was absolutely, whoever read the traditions, and I don't know if that was a goof or not, but every alcoholic should be self-supporting. I like that. And I was absolutely not self-supporting. I was a leech, and I would suck anybody dry who would give me the chance. You know, right before going into that treatment center, see, the way I roll, I'll get a girlfriend, and I know it's not working out, and I know we should break up, but what I'll do is I'll be the biggest jerk in the world, and, like, for example, with this last one, you know, that I'm talking about, I spent all of her money, and I want you to support me, so that's the deal. So I want to sit around and do nothing. And then she lost her job because she, you know, I had brought her into this lifestyle that I was living. So then I convinced her that we should blow through all her credit because she had some decent credit at the time. And you know, that's how I roll when I'm out there with no solution and no AA and no God in my life. I am just a mess. And I create just drama and just a mess everywhere. You know, I got her family hating me. They're hating her. They don't know what she's doing. And that's kind of, I just snowballed through life, just taking down anybody that would give me an opportunity to run them dry, basically. And it's sad to say, but that's exactly how I live my life when I don't have God in AA. So like I said, I'm on the south side at this treatment center. I get out, I got everything I own in a trash bag. And my parents don't know that I left the program, so I can't go to their house. I got like a day left on this bus pass that they give you to get around on, you know, and get a job and all that stuff. And I got a job when I was down there at the Hurricane, the bar on St. Pete Beach. And I was just doing my thing there, and they got hip to it, and they were about to kick me out, so I left. And so I got like a day or two left on the bus pass, and I ride the bus. It's like 4 hours or something to get from St. Pete to Newport Richey on a bus. And I took that trip, and I wound up in Newport Richey at this duplex. And, you know, the kind of people I was hanging out with and the kind of places I was hanging out with, the neighbor had a domestic dispute. And when the cops come, they run everybody's ID because they know everybody that's hanging out there has got some kind of warrant or, you know, these are the kind of places I'm hanging out. And they came in and they knocked on the door that I was staying in. You know, they were at the dispute next door, and they came in and they ran my ID. And sure enough, I got a warrant because I'm, you know, absconded from the program, and I go to jail. And that, you know, I was there on a VOP, and every other time I could convince somebody to, you know, bond me out, or never really stayed in jail ever. You know, the most was a few days, a handful of days. And this time I got stuck there, and they were bringing AA meetings in. This solution was absolutely available there. There was big books all over. There were like big books, 12 and 12s, grapevines. There were Spanish grapevines. There was, the whole deal was in there. And I didn't want anything to do with it. And 6 months later, I walked out, and, you know, I was the same exact person, probably worse, you know, probably worse, because I was sober for that time and just living with me. So from that date to my sobriety date is like 6 months. And it was just basically when I got out of jail, it was, they let you out at midnight in Pasco County. And so I get out at midnight, and it was like midnight of my mother's birthday. So my parents come and pick me up, and no, hey, how's it going? How was your birthday? You know, just like, it was all about me. I got in the car and you know, we headed for home, and they had some ground rules, and I had to go to AA. I had to work for my dad's business. Something else. I wasn't really listening because I wasn't planning on following any of them. And they took me home, and, you know, every time they take me home, they deck me out. I get new clothes, and, you know, they really look after me. And by this time, I'm just not working. I'm a leech. I'm just fresh out of the county jail. And so I got these new clothes, and I was like, all right, well, I'll go to work tomorrow, but let me go the next day, because when I got arrested, I lost my ID, and I didn't need an ID. I didn't have a car. I wasn't going anywhere. But, you know, I was like, well, let me go get the ID. So they went to work, and I stayed home, and I went to the DMV. I walked up there. And I seen a kid that I was locked up with at the DMV when I was getting my license, and they gave me money for the license, and I think some like lunch money to buy some lunch. And, you know, it's pathetic, really. And, you know, that was, that began the run right there, you know. And, it was pathetic. And, you know, I think I showed up back at the house that day, but they were like, you got to go, you know. And by this point, my mom was in Al-Anon, and they were actually sticking to these rules, you know, and they were like, you're not staying here and doing this crap that you do, and not, you're not putting us through it anymore. And so I said, fine. And I went in my room and I packed up all these clothes that they had just bought me and I took off. And that's the kind of guy I am. And I got on that couch tour where I stay at someone's house until I eat all their food and, you know, whatever, rip off one of their drug dealers, and then they kick me out, and then I go to the next house, and I got on that deal, and drinking every day, and just, you know, any kind of bridge that anyone let me cross, I'd torch it right to the, you know, as soon as I got over it, I was torching it, and just really just ruining relationships everywhere I went, really just adding to my ninth step, my eighth and ninth step. But basically, like I said, there was 6 months there from when I got out of the county jail to when my sobriety date is today, and it were just the most god-awful 6 months of my life. And I hope to God that, you know, that's my last drunk, because it was pathetic. It was terrible. Every day was the same exact day. You know, Monday, the same as Tuesday. Christmas Day, every day was the same day. It was survival. It was pathetic. It wasn't that fancy getting dressed up, going to Ybor drinking. It was pathetic. It was me by myself. I was in the Tahitian, which if you've never been, it's a beautiful motel up in Holiday. It's disgusting. It's like abandoned or in foreclosure right now. So I was staying there with this lady that everybody calls Hooker Michelle, and it was just that's where I go. That's what I do when I'm out there. Not hookers. I mean, like that's where I end up. I end up in motel rooms, you know, with seeking the lower companion always, you know, and I don't know who was lower. She might have been seeking. I might have been lower, but you know, I absolutely. I wanted my life to end. I wanted all that crap to end. I didn't know how to face life. I didn't know how to do anything anymore. And, you know, I wasn't like, throughout high school and the first couple years out of high school, I had a job and I did things and I would like be around people and not feel like I wanted to, you know, rip their face off. And I was pretty normal, you know, from the outside looking in, and it was absolutely not like that at this time. I was just held up in these hotel rooms, and I would only come out at night and commit all kind of ridiculous crimes. And then when the sun would come up and all these normal people would start going out and the roads would start filling back up, I'd slide back into the Tahitian or, you know, the other nice motels around Main Street. And that's kind of the way I lived. And I didn't want to keep going on like that. And I absolutely, I didn't know I was saying a prayer at the time. I didn't know what I was doing. I was crying. It was a small motel room, you got to envision, and the girl's on the bed that I left detox with, and I'm crying on the floor of the motel room. And, you know, I just wanted it all to stop, and I was just saying, please stop, please stop. And this is all kind of shaky, but this was a Sunday night, and I woke up on the following, you know, a couple days later on a Tuesday, back in front of the one of these podiums and the video monitor at the Pasco County Jail. And the judge on the video screen was saying that I had been charged with a crime that was punishable by life in the Florida State Prison, and that my bond was being set at $50,000. And I was just, I had absolutely no clue what had happened over the past couple days. And I knew I was stuck there. I knew that for sure, because I knew no one I even knew besides my parents had any money, and they certainly weren't going to come bond me out. They got to the point where they knew I was safer there. And, you know, I don't know, somewhere along the line there, that idea was smashed that I could drink safely. I don't know how else to put it, but I went and detoxed in the medical wing of the county jail, and it didn't cost $35,000. And I shook and puked and everything else for, I don't know, days, like 15 days or something. And I went back down to the general population, and this kid, I always wind up in A600. That's like a pod in the county jail. And this kid that I was in there with, like, I don't know, 8 months earlier, was, he had got released, and we were both there with the same charge hanging over our head. And we started going to the AA meeting. You know, today I sponsor him, and that's amazing. That, but anyway, we both started going to the meetings that they were offering. We would go Friday nights, which is ironic because that's when our home group is now. But we would go Friday nights, and then Wednesday when they would show up, you know, the meetings would show up, we'd go. And I don't know. I don't know. Looking back, I can absolutely see that the hand of God was involved in all this. I had no clue at the time. I just felt like something was different. Something needed to be changed. I knew that I needed to do something different. And so I started going to the meetings. Okay. I started going to the meetings that they offered. And charge got reduced a couple times. And I ended up going to prison because of my previous record. And if you've never been to prison, I steal one of Roger's lines, Chris. If you've never been to prison, I recommend you go, because it's wonderful. Someone does your laundry, and someone cooks your food, and if you're lucky enough, you'll get into a relationship. And you know, but I can honestly say that, you know, because that's where I got my first relationship with a power greater than myself. You know, I wound up at a prison in North Florida that didn't have AA meetings being brought in. And I seen I was walking to the rec yard one day on a Saturday afternoon, and I saw a guy carrying a stack of Grapevine magazines. And I went up to him, and we just started talking AA. You know, he asked me everything about my drinking and told me everything about his. And I identified with him on the rec yard. For the first time in my life, I identified with another drunk. And my life absolutely changed from that point forward. I had no clue what was going on at the time. He gave me the instructions to write a fourth step. We discussed the first three steps. We walked that rec yard for, like, I don't know, whatever, the 3 or 4 hours. We just stayed walking, taking laps, and talking. And he was about to go home. His sentence was about to be over. So I wrote an inventory. I shared things with this guy that I was never going to tell another person. And, you know, it was the absolute, it was the first time I did anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. This dude was, by every definition, a active member of Alcoholics Anonymous behind those gates. And you know, my life changed from that point forward. I felt more free on that rec yard than I have ever felt in my entire life. And it just put me on fire for AA. He ended up going home, like, I don't know, not long after that, a couple weeks. And I had like 2 months left to do. So I get out 2 months later, and I'm really jazzed up about AA. And I'm, you know, you couldn't have told me that I didn't belong here. You couldn't have told, I didn't, I was, this was my thing from here on out. And I knew it. I just kind of had this feeling. And, you know, I got out of prison, and I got involved with, my home group, and that's where my sponsor was. I saw this guy when I was coming and going in and out of AA, and, I was never really coming and going. I never really did a thing when I was here, but, you know, in my mind, I thought I was coming and going. And but I met this guy, and I had his phone number. And when I got out of prison, I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said yes. And we got right back into the big book, and he's still my sponsor today. And he knows where I am right now, and all that. He knows everything about me. So we made plans. I was like, I don't know, a month or two out of prison, and we made plans to go to the international convention. And so Sean, myself, and this newcomer that was hanging out with us drive across. It was like middle of the night. We made the plan, so we had no plane tickets or anything. We drove out there, and so we get to San Antonio, and we're not in San Antonio in like 10 minutes. We went to a McDonald's, and then we went to the whatever, the registration to register. And we're on our way into the registration hall, and there's the dude standing right there that took me through the steps in prison. And I was like, what? I was like hitting Sean. I'm like, look at this dude. This is the guy, you know? He's like, what the hell are you talking about? So I would have just thought that was a coincidence, you know? No big deal. But, you know, today I absolutely know that that was the hand of God involved in all that. You know, my life keeps improving, and you know, I have this awakened spirit today, and I can see all that kind of stuff happening around me, and I can see it happening to the guys that I sponsor. And I would have missed all that stuff before. I wasn't awake to any of that stuff. The first year I was out, I was going to a lot of meetings on the weekends with my grand sponsor. We would get in the car and travel down here to the Saturday night meeting and just kind of drive all over and hit different meetings. And we were heading down to this one, and I'm chronically late. That's why Sean drove tonight. But I'm getting a little better. But I was late that night, and I didn't get home to change in time. And I was like, Dan, I don't know if it's going to work out. He's like, no big deal. Just get dressed now. We'll go to an 8 o'clock. We'll go to Blind Pass. So we wound up going to St. Pete, and we weren't going out there really ever. So we get to Blind Pass, and there was two spots open right in front of the podium. No, you know, it was a speaker meeting on Saturday nights, and no other spots. So we hustle in, and we get there, and you know, the speaker that night is my fiance now, and I'm going to marry her in December. And you know, I wasn't any kind of marriage material. I couldn't even take care of myself, you know, and today we got this awesome relationship. You know, she is out chairing a big book meeting right now, and I'm here doing this, and we put AA first, and we have an amazing life together. Let's see what's going on here. Just this weekend, her twin brother and her celebrated a birthday, and it was on Father's Day, so we had a whole bunch of AA people at my house, and had a real good time. And when everybody left, I had my dad's Father's Day gift, and it was like my parents were there, and her and I. And so I gave my dad his Father's Day gift, and because I learned how to tell this guy how I felt, I wrote something nice in a card. And for that second when he read it, I saw, you know, something happen. I saw like a little spark over his eye. And he got up and he walked to the bathroom. And when he came out, he gave me a big old hug. And he said, I love you. And, you know, we don't hug ever, you know. But he gave me a double arm hug. And, you know, that was the first name on my resentment list. You know, that... How does that happen? How do I go from hating this guy? And I really never hated him. I was always seeking his approval and just wanting him to love me. And he loved me the whole time. But how do I go from that to where I was at Sunday? You know, it just... This program is absolutely amazing. And welcome to the new people, the people coming back. The congratulations to the people that picked up Chips. Kelly, thank you for your lead. I would have missed all this stuff. I would have totally missed every bit of this because I was just living a life that I absolutely believe that I would have been dead if I would have kept up living the way I was. You can't tell me any otherwise because, I mean, I kept winding up in emergency rooms. I do really stupid things when I'm out there, and they're not stupid things, but they're things that people that are caught up in the grip of obsession that no human power could deliver me from. That's the kind of stuff that I do when I'm out there. And to see that look on my parents' face when they're coming to visit me at the hospital or through a visitation glass, you know, that I know today that I never have to see that look on their face again. And, you know, that stuff was just becoming part of the deal. You know, that was just, they're mad at me again, you know, my life is totally different from that today. I got a pretty boring, normal life. I get up, I go to work every day. I give my father an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and I'm a worker amongst workers, and I knew nothing about that before I started working these principles into my life. I knew absolutely nothing about that. Right when I got out of prison, my home group, we had a business meeting, and they gave me, the supply person had left. Like, they were, I don't know if they got drunk, but they couldn't pick up the supplies anymore. So this dude was like, here, I nominate Chris to go to the store and do that. So they gave me the group's debit card, you know, to go buy styrofoam cups and sugar and creamer. I mean, that might not be a big deal to anybody sitting in this room. And I know it is, because I know you guys know about that. But for someone to trust me with their money and give me the PIN number, I mean, come on, I got 6 felonies on my record. I mean, that's like ridiculous to think, here, yeah, run to the store. But that's what happens around here. That's what happens when people see the change. Because I was coming around enough, just that much, just that little bit enough to where people got to know me a little, but I never let them get to know me, but they saw my face. You know, I hung out with Steven one time when he first got out of treatment, and we went bowling and everything else, and I was like, I gotta go get drunk. This sucks, you know. But like, so people kind of knew who I was, but then to see when I come back and that they saw something different, to trust me to go take a debit card to the store, is just blows me away. And that same person that nominated me to do the debit card deal was leaving town, and he nominated me to be the group GSR. And I was like, you got to be kidding. I was like, I was looking for another Chris at the business meeting. I was like, Chris, me, Chris? And I've rotated out since then. But, you know, I would have missed every bit of this. I would have missed everything. And I got a life today that's absolutely second to none. I wouldn't trade my life for a thing. You know, I got the respect of my family. I go to work. I know my neighbors. My neighbors know me. Just stupid things like that. But it's not stupid, because I used to shut myself in my apartment. I used to not check the mail. You know, I used to not feed my animals. I used to let them get out and just whatever happens to them. Today I'm accountable. I got 2 cats and a dog, and you know, a fiance, and I got a pretty normal life from the outside looking in, and I don't know how the hell you get there from where I was at. You know, I truly believe that I was that I was dying, and I can absolutely identify with our first speaker, because I'm happy, joyous, and free today, and I owe it all to you guys, so thanks for my life.